We're all the way into spring. The grass is growing, flowers are blooming, dandelions are out. And you may be wondering what you should be doing to keep everything on track in your lawn and garden. Well, we'll be talking about what you can do to keep your plants in good shape as we transition from spring to summer. I'm Jim Meadows. Today on Focus, we welcome your lawn and garden care questions for Sandra Mason, horticulture educator with the University of Illinois Extension. We do these shows from time to time to help with problems in the home landscape, and we can take a whole range of questions on anything from trees and shrubs to vegetables and flowers, even houseplants. Plus, Extension lawn expert Tom Voigt will be with us today to answer questions about everything from growing grass in those shady sites to controlling grubs and other insect pests. Your lawn and garden care questions answered today on Focus. That's coming up after the news. Welcome to another Lawn and Garden edition of Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Horticulture educator Sandy Mason from the University of Illinois Extension is back today to answer your gardening questions. Good morning, Sandy.
Good morning.
And for questions about your lawn, we are turning to another Extension specialist. Tom Voigt is an associate professor in the Department of Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois College of ACES, our Agriculture, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. He's been on Focus before talking about grasses as a potential biofuel source, but today we're just talking about your lawn. So welcome to Focus, Tom.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
And first question, well, we were just talking, this is interesting sort of crop for an event coming up, and that's butterflies.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's one of those things. I think more and more people have interest in butterflies. And then just the fact that I think, you know, there's a lot of things in the news about the concern about the populations of butterflies, and especially with like monarchs and how we're concerned about the lower populations of those. Well, we have a great program coming up on May 20th, which is a Monday, and it starts at 7 o'clock. It's at the U of I Extension office in Champaign. And we actually have two authors that are coming. It's Wayne Richards and Judy Burris. And they've written several books on butterfly gardening and butterfly life cycles. They have fantastic photography. So it's just going to be a great evening to find out more about butterflies. And it's open to the public, free of charge. You don't have to register. So it's May 20th at the U of I Extension office in Champaign and 7 o'clock. So hopefully people can drop by and say hello and find out more about butterflies.
Okay. Well, your lawn and garden questions are welcome by phone or online. You can call 333-9455 or call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL for the toll-free number. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. You know, one thing I'm wondering now that everything looks, we've had a lot of rain. We've even had some flooding. Everything's extremely green right now. It wasn't that way a year ago. Are you surprised that it's so green now, considering how dry it was last summer?
Well, I'm not so surprised about the lawns being looking as good as they do. We started getting a little rain last August, and the grasses that we use as lawn grasses in this part of the country are cool season grasses, and they perform well and grow optimally in the fall and then again in the spring. And so the grasses were able to recover somewhat from the drought that we had up until August, and they're certainly taking advantage of the weather we're having this spring. They perform well in cool conditions, and we're certainly keeping our temperatures in a good range for their growth, and we also have plenty of moisture. One of the things that I do have a little concern about for the future with lawn grasses is that this is the time of year that the grasses make the roots, the most amount of roots for during the course of a year, the spring period. And because there's so much moisture and because it's so wet, the soils are so wet, the grasses, A, are not going to make deep roots. They don't need to because there's moisture at the surface. And they're not able then also to make deep roots because there's not oxygen in the root zone is flooded once you get down a few inches. And so the roots are going to be fairly shallow. If we go into a hot, dry period in, later in the summer, and we've done that in, I think in 2011 and maybe 2010, we had some conditions where we had wet soils in the spring, and then it turned dry in June and July. And the lawns tend to suffer when they don't have adequate roots going into the hot, dry period. They go dormant pretty quickly. So I think that's something we need to watch out for as we get into the summer. The lawns that are well drained in those years tended to perform best throughout the course of the summer because the well drained root zone allowed the water to move through and the roots to get down to the depth that they could grow. They weren't restricted by a real wet condition in the soils.
Sandy, do these similar problems present themselves for non-grass types of plants?
Well, I think they all take advantage of, I think, of this time. And probably for a lot of those deeper-rooted plants, I think you're going to run into those same kind of problems, I should say, with some of the ornamentals when the soil is really wet and it doesn't have the oxygen. We forget that roots actually need oxygen, and they need water, but they also need oxygen in there. And so if you have really poorly drained soils, high clay content soils, anyway, you may find that some of those plants, you know, they look fine now because the temperatures are moderate. But as, again, what Tom was saying, once we start getting into that hotter, drier time, you may find they're not doing as well because they don't have that extensive root system, or it's been so wet that they've actually lost roots. You know, the roots go ahead and die and then rot. And then so it's one of those things I want to enjoy the green and all that stuff now. And we don't want to think too much about the future. But people shouldn't be too terribly surprised if they have poorly drained soils, and then plants start to suffer later on because of those root system problems.
Now, do we have any situations? Could there be any damage that plants have suffered from the dry weather last year that they're still feeling the effects of now that made them more fragile?
Right. Absolutely. So last year, maybe the roots might have died back simply because they didn't have the moisture. And then, you know, now, obviously, in the beginning of the season, before we had too terribly much rain, they were able to recover maybe some roots at that point. But then it starts getting wet again, then the roots can certainly die from too wet. So we see whenever we have these extremes like this, we're going from dry, the roots can die, wet, the roots can die, and that we don't think about that because we're not seeing it. We see the above ground effects where people might see tip dieback on trees or shrubs or whatever. So I think it's one of those things we're just going to have to sort of kind of baby things along. If you did have something that didn't look well after last year and it's still maybe struggling a little bit, you might find that when it's hot and dry, you may find you have to do a little watering.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're talking lawn and garden issues with U of I Extension horticultural expert Sandy Mason and lawn expert Tom Voigt. If you have questions for Tom or Sandy, call us at 333-9455, toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. You can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL. Or 1-800-222-WILL. The lawns look like they're doing fine out there, Tom, but are there things that you should be doing at this time of year to make sure that they're going to look good throughout the summer?
Yeah, absolutely, Jim. The spring, again, is a time when our lawns grow optimally, and we need to take advantage of that optimal growth. So the first fertilization of the spring should be put down. Matter of fact, I have a holiday fertilization schedule, and Mother's Day is my first fertilizer application, a holiday for the growing season. So this is a very appropriate time to apply your first application of fertilizer for the year. There are weeds that can be controlled now. Certainly we've seen lots of dandelions this year. They are controlled post-emergently with materials that are applied when the weeds are actively growing, and they certainly are actively growing. So we'll be seeing an opportunity to control dandelions and other broadleaf weeds like white clover and creeping charlie Here in May. Crabgrass, hopefully you've put down your crabgrass pre-emergent herbicide by this point.
Crabgrass is something you should get to work on earlier.
That is because the material is put down to be taken taken into the weed when it's germinating and growing, and those weeds start to germinate when soil temperatures are relatively cool. Typically, we'd say the last week of April in a normal year would be a good time to put down your pre-emergence products around here. I think we probably, with the cool conditions we have and the cool soils, we're probably still okay to get those down, but I wouldn't wait a whole lot longer on putting your pre-emergence herbicides down. And that would control crabgrass, weeds that people sometimes will call water grass. It'll control barnyard grass and foxtails and that type of thing.
And meanwhile, for the dandelions and other weeds of that nature, you can start going after them now, and it'll work.
Yes, yeah, and that's a different type of herbicide is used on dandelions and broadleaf weeds, and it's a post-emergence, meaning that the weed is up and actively growing. So you apply it after the weed has emerged or post-emergence, and that's applied to control the weeds. And this is a great time to go after those broadleaf weeds.
I know the appearance of dandelions is always one of my personal symbols of knowing, yes, it is now spring when the dandelions get out here. But I couldn't help thinking of dandelions. I'm sort of equal time for the other side. I remember reading many years ago Ray Bradbury's novel, Dandelion Wine, which is a nostalgic novel about growing up in a small Illinois town in the 1920s with a grandmother who made dandelion wine, one of the just a few lines talking about the annual ritual of the wine from a child's point of view. Hold summer in your hand, pour summer in a glass. A tiny glass, of course, the smallest tingling sip for children. Change the season in your veins by raising glass to lip and tilting summer in. And as I was looking this up, I did not know that Tom had a dandelion wine tradition in his own family.
My grandpa used to make dandelion wine, and I don't remember anybody liking it.
He made it, but only he liked it.
Yeah, and I don't remember ever having an opportunity to taste it, but it was down in the basement of his farmhouse, out in the country. So
you make it from the flowers?
I think from the flowers he made it, yeah.
And there's plenty of them.
and I think there are people who argue for dandelions. Let's see. If I Google in dandelion salad, here is a recipe for it. And, half a pound of torn dandelion greens, one half red onion chopped, two tomatoes chopped, half a teaspoon dried basil, salt and pepper to taste, tossed together in a medium bowl. So it can be done. There's a picture here, and those are obviously dandelion greens. I recognize that shape. However, if you're going to do this, I take it that any applications, any weed killers and things that you've put on the lawn should be avoided.
Well, yeah, I don't think you'd want to consume any parts of the dandelion plant if there's a chance of any pesticides or weed control products that have been put down.
But if you're just one of the folks who let the dandelions and other weeds run free, fertilizer would not be a danger, for instance, if that's been applied.
Shouldn't be. But I'm certainly not a culinary dandelion culinary expert.
I think you'd want the leaves when they're young, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would
I think they'd be tough.
Well, dandelions seem to be always planting themselves, so
You'd always have some young ones.
You know, I was telling Jim before we got started, I've seen pictures of row crop dandelions grown as
really?
A row crop on the East Coast.
Oh.
Yeah, or for the greens.
I would imagine, dandelions have a pretty aggressive root structure compared to grasses, I understand. Like a lot of weeds, are they fairly opportunistic plants?
They develop a fairly good-sized taproot, and if you're pulling them, you need to get out a major percentage of the taproot so that the weed won't regrow. I was mentioning I don't know of a setting. I don't know of a specific setting where dandelions are most commonly found. They seem to be grow widely. They're in my flower beds or my lawn. They grow in some light shade. They grow in full sun, moist soils, dry soils. They seem to be pretty ubiquitous and able to tolerate a wide range of environmental conditions.
But most people are not trying to cultivate dandelions on purpose, so maybe there's not much of a challenge to it. We do have a caller in on line one. I want to say good morning to Durango in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. About 5 or 6 years ago, we planted a redbud tree in our front yard after the sewer had been torn up and the dirt put back. And it seems to struggle every year. And I was just wondering if there's anything that can be done to... I heard somebody mention that clay might be down there, and maybe it's not good enough soil for it. But
so when you say it struggles, is it dying back, or it just doesn't grow very fast?
It takes a while to leaf out, and it stays basically the same size. Very little growth. Last year, it put out 10 million seeds, and somebody once told me, an arborist once told me that he had this theory that when a seed tree like that puts out a lot of seeds, it's not going to come back. So I don't know. But anyway, I was just wondering what I could do to keep it a little more vibrant and vigorous. Water it whenever I need to.
Yeah, I would think about those kind of things as far as watering during drought, those kind of things. You know, redbuds are, you know, they're native trees. They actually take a little bit of clay. They're not going to take super wet soils.
This is redbuds. Did I say crab? It's a redbud.
No. They wouldn't take. They don't necessarily take a lot of clay in the soil, but they're pretty tough overall. So I wouldn't know that necessarily that'd be a problem. I'd wonder to make sure that it hasn't been planted too deep. That's sometimes the problem. And I don't know if you planted this or somebody else planted it, but you should be able to see the root flare at the base, even on young trees.
I have mulch around it and a ground cloth, and I can't see the roots.
I would pull that away. It shouldn't be touching the trunk, number one. It should be at least 4 inches away, the mulch and the landscape fabric or whatever you're using. And when you say, so you used a landscape fabric or something that allows moisture to go through and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not plastic or anything along those lines.
Was it bald and burlapped when you planted it?
I think it was, but it's been so many years. Every year I worry about it, if it's going to die after all those years, I feel like maybe I should have done something different.
Have you tried fertilizing it just to see if you can encourage some new growth?
I fertilized it 1 year, but not since then.
I'm not sure what else to tell you on that.
If it was bald and burlap, want to look at the base of the plant to make sure that that you cut the twine away from the balling and burlapping. And is this in shade or full sun?
It's it gets shade. We have two oaks in the parkway, and in the morning till mid morning, it's relatively shady, but not really shady. But and then it's full sun, like at noon, and then the house shades it later in the day.
Yeah, because it's an understory. Right. It's an understory plant, so that shade. You know, sometimes in full sun, they may need a little. If it's hot and dry, it may need a little help. More help. Yeah,
I think I'd probably pull the landscape fabric away, to be honest with you, and really pull it away. And then you could certainly put the mulch back on, but sometimes that landscape fabric, it really holds on to the moisture more than you might think. And so I think I would just pull that away at least a couple feet, and you can cut it away and then put the mulch back over it, not put the mulch right next to the tree trunk. I'd kind of pull it away there. And then you have access to where you could go ahead and fertilize it. In that kind of, you know, where the ball would have been or is. And then see if you're going to encourage some growth with some fertilization and then kind of go from there. They do get, redbuds do get some disease issues, but typically we would probably see that as dieback. We probably see it, you know, later on as the trees get older. But they're normally great trees and for the most part pretty tough trees, not horribly long-lived trees, but pretty nice native trees to have. And I hear that theory a lot about the whole idea of, you know, they put on a lot of seeds that they're going to die. I don't know that that's necessarily the case. Redbuds tend to put on, you know, they flower a lot, and so they tend to put on a lot of seeds. So I'm not sure there's always that really correlation between the two, even though I hear it a lot.
Might be not death necessarily, but stress. Oftentimes a plant that's going to that's flowering heavily and seeding heavily may be a little stressed.
And certainly
the weather we had the last couple of years would lead to stressful conditions.
We were all under stress last year.
Well, it's one of the ones that's kind of more like a bush thing. And I planted at the same time one that's more tall next to the house, to the south side of the house. And it's shot up. It's like...
Yeah. You know, once in a while you do get certain plants that just really aren't as vigorous for any number of reasons. And I think you're on the right track as in how much time do I want to continue to give this tree or do I want to try and replace it, that kind of thing. So I think I might give it, you know, last year to me was a gimme on plants. If they survived last year, that's fine. I didn't expect them to thrive. So last year was a gimme. I would just encourage you to maybe go ahead and fertilize it. Maybe give it another year. If it doesn't seem like it's going to do anything, then you might consider replacing it.
Yeah, if you go to replant in that area, you may want to dig down a little bit because if you said there was something there prior to the tree being planted, you make sure that there's not anything buried underneath it or there's not that would alter drainage or movement of water through.
Well, the sewer was dug up.
Okay, so
8 or 9 feet down, and they filled it in.
Okay. And so you might have gotten some pretty bad backfill in there or, might not. Yeah, I'd look at that before I replanted something in that spot. Mm-hmm. Check it out a little bit.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Good luck.
Thank you. Bye. Let's go ahead to line four. Line four with Kathy in Piatt County. Good morning, Kathy. You're on Focus.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much. First of all, a rose question. I have several kinds of roses from a really old, unknown, really, really sticker rose to a tea. And I am always hesitant about pruning them. And this year they've exploded. They're so full. Is it too late to trim them back?
Personally, I would go ahead and trim them because if you think about it, what they're going to look like, you know, how well they're doing now, just think of how much more growth they're going to be putting on. So what's it going to look like at the end of the season when you have, you know, another foot or so of growth? Now, some of them are already starting to put on flower buds. And when you say
these aren't,
Okay. And I don't know if this old one in particular, a lot of those older ones are actually early bloomers. And so Okay. So you may want to wait until after it flowers to at least enjoy the flowers. It's not going to kill it if you do it now, but you might lose the flowers for the season.
No. But the pictures in the books always show cutting it back to like three little stalks. I have such a hard time with that. But
yeah, we probably do that.
I will force myself.
Well, you don't necessarily. I mean, it's up to you. And usually on those, when they do that really hard pruning, and those are really typically on ones that are really vigorous tea, the hybrid teas and stuff that are really vigorous. Also, I've noticed those knockout roses that, you know, everybody has and people didn't necessarily prune them. Now they're huge.
Yeah,
so I'd really encourage, you know, cutting those back now personally and really give them a hard prune, maybe back to 8 to 10 inches and really give them a hard prune because they flower on new wood. So it doesn't matter, you know, you're going to set the flowering back a couple weeks, but they'll be fine. But they just get huge.
Well, you're right. I will. And my next question is, it sounds so basic, but I have a ground cover that I planted in a difficult spot and is just so happy. And I don't even know the name of it, but it does not flower, but it stays green and it's vigorous. But this year, all kinds of grass has sprouted up in it. So since it doesn't flower, should I just trim it off with a weed trimmer? Or surely I don't have to dig all that up and pull out the grass.
Well, I imagine the grass that's spread in. You have a lawn adjacent to the bed where the ground cover is grown. Yeah, I imagine it's Kentucky bluegrass. I would expect, and that's spread by rhizomes or underground stems out of your lawn and into your bed. You might want a couple things. You might want to put a nice edge on the bed, digging a little trench or putting some type of edging around the bed to try to deter the Kentucky bluegrass from spreading in there. You can pull that. I would say that you could also, if the grass is considerably taller than the ground cover, you may want to look at something like Roundup as a wick, meaning that you're just going to touch the foliage of the grass with the chemical. Don't let it drip or touch the ground cover, the desirable plants. But there are wicks that kind of look like a hockey stick or a golf club. With a sponge at the base of where the club portion of a golf club would be. And the Roundup then is passed through a reservoir by a tube into the sponge, and you could then just wipe that on the foliage of the grass above the ground cover. But again, you don't want to touch the Roundup on your desirable plants.
Okay, and then that would be my last question, is that there's so much conflicting advice, because we have birds and we also try to encourage butterflies and hummingbirds. And they say, absolutely, you know, don't use herbicides, pesticides, insecticides. So would that be, should I just limit my use of Roundup?
Well, certainly Roundup is a herbicide. Roundup is a non-selective herbicide, meaning that it can probably kill or damage a wide spectrum of plants. It needs to be taken into the plant by green and actively growing tissue. And so it does not move in the soil readily. It breaks down pretty readily in the soil. So I guess the choice is yours. If you're just wiping down those offending grass blades, I'm not sure that you're feeding anything. I'm not sure that anything is going into your ground cover. If they want to eat the grass, they'll go on the lawn and eat it. They don't necessarily have to, you know, they don't have to go into the ground cover and eat individual stalks if they get more bang for their buck in your lawn. Generally in settings like that, the Kentucky bluegrass offending grass will pull quite easily, but it's still much more labor intensive to pull that than it would be to try to wick it out with a Roundup.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your help.
Thank you, Kathy.
Have a good day.
Let's go on to our next caller on line 2, Terry in Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi, I've got a question about lilac bushes.
Mm-hmm.
I've got three of them. One is the old, plain old purple variety, and the other two are, you know, similar kind, but they're hybrids. One's white, one's a dark pink. And last year, all of them just flowered like crazy. And I did do a little bit of pruning about a week or so after all the blooming was done. And I know that, you know, it takes 3 years for that area to bloom again. Anyway, this year, the old-fashioned purple lilac is blooming like crazy, and the other two are just, you know, they put out like three flowers, and the leaves look strange. Some of them are, instead of, you know, coming to, you know, at the proper shape, they're a little rounded, they have a little bit of black on them, and I don't know what's going on, but it's only those two, the hybrid.
Hmm. You can't see it, but Tom and I are looking at each other, perplexed.
are the leaves on the hybrid lilacs? Well, first off, are the hybrids much younger than the old heritage type?
Yeah, well, they've been for about 15 years, and these, I think, this is their fifth year.
They should. You know, I was going to wonder if the old one had a much more extensive root system again that was impacted less by the drought because of its a more extensive nature than the newer ones.
The old fashioned one got a lot less watering last summer than the two hybrids. They got watered more frequently because they're closer to a bunch of perennials that I wanted to keep alive.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't happen to shear them, did you, when you prune these?
No. I went in, they tell you if there's something that's getting really big and fat or it's getting too tall or you want to get rid of that, you know, you just sort of get rid of that, which I did. But, you know, I cut off a lot of lilacs last year to put into vases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the only reason I say
all the time.
Yeah, they just don't take shearing well. That's the one thing I've noticed with those newer varieties. But so you have to cut down to where there's a, you know, a side branch, that kind of thing. That's when you prune those.
Do you think maybe I when I cut lilacs last year on those bushes, I didn't cut them properly?
Well, I'm just saying, I was just asking the question, because when you shear those, they don't tolerate it at all. From what I can tell, they just don't flower well after shearing. And shearing is mean like head shears. That's why I asked the question. It sounds like that's not what you did. So.
Yeah, and I really couldn't understand why some of the leaves, you know, instead of, you know, having that sort of, it's not really a heart shape, but you know what I'm talking about.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But instead they're more rounded, and then where the pointy tip should be, it's just sort of curled under a little brown, a little black.
It almost sounds like maybe they got damaged when they were in the bud, and then as they expanded, they tend to be a little bit deformed and all that stuff. So I'm not sure exactly why they would have been damaged in the bud necessarily.
They're not cupping or growing in a real distorted fashion, are they? They're twisting in...
Well, they look distorted to me.
Okay. Lawn herbicide, broadleaf herbicide will sometimes cause leaves to distort and grow with puckers or cups and twisting and. So if you've applied a broadleaf herbicide recently, I would look at the leaves or go on the internet and look up a herbicide damage.
But that wouldn't affect the flowering, because flowers set last year, didn't they?
Well, but they're going to develop this year. I mean, the flower buds are set, but then as they develop, it certainly, so it'd be a timing kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it would be the other thing, usually, depending on when it was happening, is that usually, even if it was sort of damaged in the bud, usually then that newer growth, it starts to grow out of it, and you would typically also see that probably, depending on when it happened, if there was any kind of herbicide drift, you'd actually see it, then the new leaves would look fine.
Oh, okay.
So you might look at it again to see if it's actually putting on halfway decent leaves now. If it's still not putting on decent leaves and they still seem like there is a problem, then I guess it could have been some disease issues, but it doesn't seem like it'd be quite right timing-wise to have a disease going on right now.
And it is now I would think about drainage also, make sure that the area is well-drained enough. We have certainly received an abnormal amount of precipitation this last couple of months. So,
okay, so possibly it's I'll have to look into whether it's herbicide damage and drainage, and potentially it was budding just at the wrong time for the weather.
Possibly. But I will tell you, the one thing you can do if you want to take a sample to the U of I Plant Clinic, you certainly can do that. It's on the fourth floor of Turner Hall. And it's great, you know, bring a decent sample. If it just seems like it's still not growing out of it, then I might encourage you to take a sample in. I think it's $15 for a sample. And if you have any pictures of the actual shrubs, that helps. So especially if this seems to be continuing, it might be good to do some investigation. But I think pretty much the kinds of things that Tom and I have been talking about, they probably should grow out of it, unless it's truly gotten so much water that it's gotten root damage, and then now it's just really not growing well at all.
Okay. Well, thanks very much.
Uh-huh.
Thank you very much for your call, Terry. We have another caller standing by, and we will get right back to that caller after this short break. This is Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows. We're back on Focus on WYLL with horticulture expert Sandy Mason of the University of Illinois Extension and Extension lawn expert Tom Voigt. They're taking your questions on lawn and garden care. The phone number is to call 333-9455. Our call toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller on the line from Belgium, Illinois. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes, and good morning to you all. I would like to revisit an earlier caller that talked about red buds. I'm over here along the edge of the eastern central time zone, and I really don't have a problem with them. Maybe he's over-loving them just a little bit. I have red buds that are a foot and a half in diameter, which means it's a very, very old red bud.
Right, right.
I also have red buds that are growing in my gutters.
Mm-hmm.
I have red buds that grow in my yard. I have red buds that grow in my lawn, in my gardens. I have red buds that grow in other red buds. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
they just grow everywhere. So maybe just let them go because they are they're an extremely hardy tree.
They are tough little trees. They really are.
I mean, I've hacked limbs off of them that get rot up through them and felt sorry about it because I found a little bud coming off of a half-dead limb. So I think you might be just loving it a little bit. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And here's a question that came in on email from Amy. I am looking for a ground cover that grows under the eaves, close to the house, on the west-facing side. Plus, we have two big maples very close to the house. Basically, something that will grow well in dry, shady soil, and if it is invasive, I do not care. It also has to be something that will not be poisonous for dogs, though. Not poisonous for dogs. The soil is not good, so I would also like to know what we need to add to make the soil more airy and favorable to plant growth. Any help you give is appreciated.
I think there's groups of ground covers that I think are quite tough and I can't tell you about dogs, but hostas, for example, don't kill slugs. So
I think they're good.
Yeah. So hostas are there's a wide variety of sizes, colors, tolerances to shade. That would be a plant to look at. I think Agapodium.
You don't care if it spreads.
That's right. Yeah, that's pretty. That's a pretty. That'll tolerate a variety of conditions and grows pretty well. Too well, and for many people's tastes.
I think it is one of those things that if dry shade, I think, is one of the tougher ones.
Yeah.
I mean, it, because of that. And I think, and you said the soil wasn't good. And maybe adding some compost might help before planting. This would be the time to do that. And that would help increase organic matter, and then hopefully it would grow things a little bit better. I think of a couple of things of barrenwort. I don't think that's a problem. Epimedium, it's called. It seems to be pretty good in shadier environments. Alamium is probably another one. Again, it probably does better if it has a little bit of moisture. And I think what you'll find probably a lot of these ground covers, if you can at least water them the first year as they get established, then they're much more drought tolerant than the second, third, and then from then on. But pretty much everything, if it's like super dry, you're probably going to have to water it that first year.
Okay.
So hopefully it gives some ideas.
So hostas, and just to going down the list again, hostas.
Barrenwort, lamium, or dead nettle. It has a horrible name, but dead nettle.
Okay.
Little shrub that I've been growing, but I don't know, it's probably pretty hard to find, is Hancock Schnault coral berry.
Hmm. That is a mouthful. Hancock Schnault
coral. It's a coral berry.
It's
in the genus Amphoricarpus, and it is a little kind of a rambling shrubby type of coral berry. And I've got it in dry shade, and it seems to be it gets probably about 18 inches tall. Kind of waves and rolls over. It doesn't grow erect or in a vase shape. And then I've got it in a south facing area, and I've also got it in shade. So it's been a nice little ground cover that I picked up a number of years ago, and it survived through pretty much a complete neglect.
Well, Amy, I hope those recommendations are helpful. Let's go ahead to a caller on line one, Mike in Aurora. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes, good morning. You had mentioned earlier about white clover. I was originally going to call about how to kill violets, but I also have some of this white clover in my yard, and it sure seems like it's hard to get rid of.
I would think these conditions are pretty good for white clover. White clover a couple conditions seem to enhance white clover's ability to invade and do well. First, low nitrogen. So if you've got a lot of clover, you might want to evaluate how you're fertilizing your lawn area. Generally, we would look at probably a minimum of three applications at a pound per 1,000 square feet of actual nitrogen at each application would be necessary over the course of a growing season to provide a pretty decent lawn. White clover also seems to do well when you have a cool and wet spring, which we certainly have had up to this point. So those conditions oftentimes enhance clover's ability to perform well as a weed. By the way, clover was a common component of lawn mixes until we had chemicals that would actually control them after World War II. So it wasn't was pretty common to buy lawn seed mixes that had a clover component. And you can still, if you hunt around, you can still see those mixes available on the internet. As far as a herbicide that would go to control clover, you might want to use a broad spectrum three-way type of mix. Surprisingly, 2,4-D does not control clover very well. But one of the materials that's mixed with 2,4-D very frequently, called Mecaprop, it's in the same chemical family as 2,4-D. That does have decent control. That will provide decent control of clover. And so, by buying a product that has those two or potentially dicamba as a third component in that, you can go after a very broad spectrum of broadleaf weeds. Violets, you mentioned, and they're particularly difficult to control, and they seem to be pretty happy this spring as well, oftentimes in low light or shadier environments, but even in full sun, I've seen good batches of dandelions. That's a little more difficult to control, and herbicides containing, or weed controls containing the herbicide triclopyr tend to be the most able to control that, and that may not be something you could find in your garden center or hardware store, and you may have to contact a landscaper or lawn care professional to apply a product like that.
Okay, you earlier in the opening they said you were going to talk today about growing grass in shade. Will you be touching on that sometime?
I was wondering, and maybe I could ask you now about if you have a shady site on your lawn.
In 25 years in extension, that's probably the number one question. Second only to why my lawn looks worse than my neighbor's and he doesn't do anything, that's a harder one to answer than the shade. Lawns and shade, no matter what it says on the grass seed box, Kentucky bluegrass and perennial ryegrass are really got very little shade tolerance. Even the types that have been identified to have shade tolerance are not very tolerant. Generally, you need to have, for something like Kentucky bluegrass or perennial ryegrass, you probably need at least 30% of full sun to even have a chance at growing a decent quality of that. That said, the fescues, both fine fescues, such as a creeping red fescue or a chewings fescue or hard fescue, are probably the most shade tolerant. And then tall fescues are also more shade tolerant. If you try to grow those grasses and they don't perform well for you in the shade, then it may be time to look at the source of the shade. If it's something you can prune, a tree or a shrub that can be pruned to allow more light and air movement, then that may be a way to handle that. If it's on the north side of your house, you obviously can't do much about moving the house or pruning the house. So in those settings, you may want to look at the ultimate shade tolerant ground cover is mulch, wood chip mulch or some of the ground covers that we mentioned, hostas, lily of the valley, pachysandra, Japanese spurge, English ivy, vinca. There's any number of ground covers that have more shade tolerance than most of our lawn grasses do. So that would be another way to look at that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mike. Let's go ahead to line two. And Carla in Champaign, good morning. You're on the
good
air
morning.
On Focus.
Thank you. I'd like to know what the latest is on the ash borer. I have three pretty large ash trees that were planted for a passive solar heated house, and they provide shade, of course, in the mm-hmm. summer, and in the winter they allow the light in. Mm-hmm. I've been treating them for the last 2 years with a liquid Bayer. I'm not sure what the latest is. I went to one of the, Home Depot and got some, but it's granular this year instead of liquid, and it's going to be very expensive. I just mm-hmm. got a couple of containers. So I'm not quite sure whether to go to a professional, what's happening with.
Well, when you ask, now, where are you located?
Southwest Champaign.
Okay. Well, Champaign County has been found in Champaign, and so we know it's here. So that's pretty much a done deal on that part. As far as, you know, you've been treating, which is one of the options that people have is treatment. I will say, and you can do it as a homeowner and purchase the products as you have done, and that's just fine. We find that, a couple things. We find on the, it tends to be the applications that you're talking about tend to be better on younger trees than on the really big ones. And I don't know how big, how what's
the... 55 to 70 inches around the trunk diameter. Okay. So they're big.
So they're big trees. So I will tell you, they're better on younger trees than some of the big guys like what you have. But you obviously have these. They're an integral part of your landscape, and you hate to lose them. I totally get that. So I will tell you, you might want to actually talk to a professional, because they actually can do trunk injections that tend to be a little bit more effective than the applications that you're doing, where you actually do soil applications. So you may want to talk to them. What we're finding is with some of the chemicals that they use, actually you can get 2 years of control with them. So you wouldn't necessarily have to do it every single year. And so if you consider the cost of the application and you actually look at it over a 2 year period, and it may be, you know, not that much more expensive, and you actually get a little better control. So I think it's probably, considering the importance of these in your landscape, I think it's a good time to start talking to a professional to see what your options are there.
And arborists are the the kind of professional we're talking about.
You'd want to look for a certified arborist. And I will tell you, not all arborists also do pesticide applications. So you may want to just check, but you're going to need to look for a certified arborist.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, good luck.
Thank you. Bye. Let's go ahead to line three. David in Urbana, you're on the air on Focus.
Hey, my question's about organic fertilizers for lawns. If you start looking around on the web for that sort of stuff, you rapidly come to the Harvard University landscape website that raves about compost tea. What's your opinion on compost tea?
I think that, well, first off, plants don't, in the case of nitrogen, for example, plants take up two forms of nitrogen, and it doesn't matter to the plant if that nitrogen came from compost tea or from manure, or if it came from ammonium nitrate or urea. So as far as actually fertilizing the plants go, it's going to be cheaper to use an inorganic fertilizer. You can get you have more control over what you're putting down because you have a known analysis within the fertilizer. That said, there are certainly benefits to organic materials as far as enhancing microbial activity in the soil, perhaps breaking down thatch, perhaps deterring disease organisms, improving the soil tilth. So there can be some benefits to the organic products. Generally, they cost more per actual unit of a mineral nutrient, and you don't, in many cases, know exactly what you're getting when you apply them, because you don't have a known analysis. You don't know how much nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and other minerals that are used by plants are contained in whatever you're applying.
Well, most of the compost tea sites, it sounds sort of like voodoo science to me. It talks about feeding the microbes, not the lawn. And so I don't really understand that. If you look at the compost tea recipes, the amount of compost or manure you put into the tea is like 1/100th or 1/1000th of the amount they recommend for top dressing of organics. And so I just don't understand the whole concept.
Well, and again, I would think you're not under those conditions. You're not fertilizing the lawn very much. You're not providing a lot of mineral nutrients that are gonna help enhance the growth of the turf. It's gonna be more of you're gonna feed the microbes, and the microbes may be good about breaking down thatch and forming humic acid, which tends to help the soil be more open and better drained, but also hold on to moisture appropriately. And that type of thing.
So I would just wonder, so I'm just asking the question about just doing a top dress of compost. Would that be... I don't know. I'm asking Tom.
Okay.
I'm just throwing this out there. Because that's certainly one of the things that sometimes we've talked about.
You know, I think if you, and I think that would be a good way to go, provided you can get good quality compost that's been screened and it's of, and I would do that in conjunction with the core aerification. You know, I would core aerify the lawn and then spread the, or put down your top dressing and then core aerify and then try to use a, some type of mat to work that into those holes. And that would enhance the soil below the, within the root zone, the shallow parts of the root zone.
How often do you recommend aerating?
I recommend aerating when it's needed. And so if you've got a real heavy soil and it's meaning a lot of clay in your soil and you have a lot of traffic on it, I can tell you that in here on campus, the IIM people generally core aerify a couple times, once in the spring, once in the fall, on many of their athletic fields, which are heavily used. So I think in a lawn, if you probably wouldn't necessarily need to do it more than once a year, and you may not need to do it, every year. Again, depending on the heaviness of the soil and the amount of traffic you get in that area on the lawn.
I'm also curious about the spring fertilizers, like from Scotts or any of the big companies. If now is the best time for root growth, phosphorus seems is best for root growth. Yet the standard fertilizers are really high in nitrogen and low in phosphorus. Does that make sense, or
we would recommend a fertilizer that's got it. If you look at those three numbers, you want them in a ratio of 3:1:2 or 3:0:2, 4:1:2 or 4:0:2 or 5:1:2 or 5:0:2. You don't want to get some that are 8:2:2 in that ratio of materials. The phosphorus is, you may have trouble in some locations finding fertilizers containing phosphorus because there's concerns about it getting into surface water. And so in many cases, they've eliminated phosphorus-containing fertilizers from your garden center or hardware store or big box stores.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to end the program there, but thank you very much for everybody who's emailed and phoned in for your questions. Thank you, David, for calling in. And thank you, Tom Voigt and Sandy Mason from the University of Illinois Extension. We'll see you back next month. Sandy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's Focus program on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. We are likely the first result in your search engine under WILL Focus. Monday on Focus, we go to summer camp, as many of you did as a kid. Some of you may be sending your own kids to camp this summer. While psychologist and author Michael Thompson says summer camps are good for children, and we'll talk about why on Monday's Focus. Focus is produced by Lindsay Moon. I'm Jim Meadows. Focus on WILL.